Podcasts for PRI's The World are made possible in part by the generous support of our donors. Visit PRI.org/give and ensure that outstanding global programming continues. After all, it's your world. Jump in.
It's Christmas Eve and all is not calm. Today, December 24th, this is The World. I'm Carol Hill, sitting in for Marco Werman. A rising tide of violence in South Sudan. We discuss what's at stake for the U.S. in one of the world's poorest countries. Plus, we follow a French photographer through the Norwegian woods in search of the Sami.
And then suddenly the forests disappear, and you're in the tundra, and then you know you're in Lapland.
And as you gear up for Christmas, we'll tell you about the original Festivus for the rest of us. It's an Eastern European tradition called Krampus. He's not for the faint of heart or the naughty.
If you're naughty and in Hungary, you could get hauled away by this demon and beaten with chains.
Wow. I'll just take the lump of coal. All that's just ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's Christmas Eve, and for many across the globe, it's a time of good cheer and fellowship. That's why it's so hard to witness what's unfolding right now in South Sudan. More than a week of ethnic violence has left more than 1,000 people dead, according to the UN, and this in one of the world's poorest, least developed countries. To find out what's going on in South Sudan, we turned to the New York Times' Nick Kulish. We spoke to him on a phone line from the capital, Juba. He visited a UN camp earlier in the day.
Well, there are thousands of people with very little in the way of shelter. They're complaining about significant shortages of water and food, and they say that they're afraid to go home for what might face them if they do.
Who are these people? So what parts of South Sudan are they coming from?
The people that are at the two UN compounds here in Juba are largely from the Nuer ethnic group, and they are mostly coming from Juba and the surroundings. And then you can still see even now, more than a week after the conflict started, you can still see buses pulling up with packed with people with bags loaded up on top.
And what do they say about what forced them out of their homes?
Well, they describe situations in which people were being rounded up based on their ethnicity. People were being shot. People were being killed. You know, it's a pretty ugly scene that's being described. You know, one guy described basically surviving only because he spoke the Dinka language and didn't have any of the typical ritual scarification on his face of Nuer people, but said that others around him were taken away and were killed. And I think, you know, it's just the little things like that, I guess, that are making a difference between life and death here and in other parts of the country.
And we should mention, you've mentioned two of the ethnic groups, Dinka and Nuer, and Dinka is the ethnic group that the president of South Sudan belongs to, President Salva Kiir, and Nuer is the ethnic group that Riek Machar belongs to. He's the vice president who was sort of kicked out of office. I think what's incredible from this distance, it seems like this happened kind of out of nowhere. A week ago, it seems like no one was thinking this would happen. What got this conflict going?
Well, I mean, I think you mentioned former Vice President Riek Machar getting kicked out of office, and that happened over the summer. You know, I think that what you had politically was a sort of uncomfortable power-sharing agreement that people knew was unstable and wasn't necessarily going to last. But I think they hoped that it would be resolved at the ballot box. And instead, it has spilled into significant violence.
You mentioned earlier that you were in South Sudan over the summer. Compare that time to now. I mean, did you have any inkling that something like this could happen?
Well, there was violence over the summer as well. which was between the Nuer and a much smaller ethnic group known as the Merle in the Jonglei state. And in a way, the sort of the idea that there was there were these tensions and disagreements that could burst into violence was there, but I don't think that anyone expected this level of violence between the country's two largest ethnic groups to essentially threaten to tear the state apart. And I think that's what we're seeing now, which is why people are so focused on it and trying so hard to stop that.
Journalist Nick Kulish, he's in South Sudan reporting for the New York Times. He's been speaking to us from Juba in South Sudan. Thanks so much, Nick.
Thanks for having me.
Back when South Sudan became an independent country in 2011, there were hopes that these kind of conflicts were a thing of the past. A peace accord had ended the long civil war with Khartoum in the north, and it was largely brokered by the United States. Ambassador Princeton Lymond helped mediate the talks between the north and south. He worked with all the principal players in the current conflict in South Sudan, including former Vice President Riek Machar and President Salva Kiir.
President Kiir is a man who comes out of the army, a man who fought for independence for some 20 years. His whole career has been in the army. He doesn't have education outside of that. He has been up to now a conciliator. Now, Riek Machar, the former vice president, has a different career path, a scholar, a PhD, a very sophisticated, articulate man. But he has a reputation also in South Sudan because in 1991, he led his forces in a break from the liberation movement and fought a very bloody battle with the SPLM. And that memory lingers.
And the SPLM was the main rebel group.
I'm sorry, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement.
So what is at issue between them?
Well, it's power. Riek Machar always had ambitions to be the president. But for the majority Dinka, remembering 1991, that was a real problem.
I want to ask, I mean, from a distance, there's a tendency to want to explain this. Oh, it's an ethnic conflict. You have a president who's of one ethnic group, in this case Dinka, and you have this vice president who's of another ethnic group, and this is an ethnic conflict. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, the problem is it can become that if you don't manage it, if you don't manage to keep that sense of unity that everybody came together in 2011 when the independence was achieved, and you make sure that these fractures aren't broken open, that all the memories don't come to the surface, and you let loose the dogs of war.
Now, what is the U.S. interest in South Sudan? You played a direct role yourself. The Obama administration has spent a lot of time on it. What's the interest?
Several things. There was a great deal of public interest in Sudan and the Sudan Civil War because of charges of slavery and religious discrimination. The North is largely Muslim, trying to impose Sharia law on a Christian South. But also the stability of that whole part of Africa. We invested a lot in the peace process, but our interest now, not only in because of this historical commitment and role in it, but the collapse of South Sudan just would have repercussions in every direction, Ethiopia, Uganda, Kenya. And that's why the regional countries in Africa have been so concerned, why their foreign ministers were there just recently. So it's a security, stability interest as well as an historical one.
Ambassador Lyman, where do we go now, whether you're talking about Sudan or the U.S. involvement there?
Well, I think there are several things that need to be done right away. And first, to increase and strengthen the UN peacekeeping mission there. We must not have another Srebrenica in South Sudan. Those tens of thousands of people who have taken refuge in the UN compounds must be protected. Second, the diplomatic efforts which are underway, my successor Don Booth is in and out of Juba, to get a ceasefire and a political process going, to figure out a pathway to these competing ambitions and how they can be managed so the country can get back to peace and development. Though that's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a lot of coordination between the Africans, Europeans, and the Sudanese.
Princeton Lyman is former U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Tonight, as little children around the world strain to hear the sound of reindeer on their rooftops, they might do well to ask Celine Clenay. She knows the sound of reindeer hooves. The Paris-based photographer has been documenting reindeer herders who live in the icy tundra of Lapland. They're known as the Sami people. To make the trip to Lapland each year, Clenay drives all the way from France to the icy tip of Norway.
Driving is the best way of traveling when you're a photographer. You go from South Europe, which is Paris for me. It is just full of highways at the beginning. Then once you're in Scandinavia, it's just so quiet, just so much forests, so much lakes. And then suddenly the forests disappear and you're in the tundra. And then you know you're in Lapland.
Now, reindeer herding is sort of fundamental to the Sami culture. And a lot of your photos are about the reindeer. These reindeer are wild, aren't they?
Yes, they are totally wild. That's the interesting thing about it, actually, because all those wild animals belong to a herder, but they are free and they are wild and there are no fences. So it's a very specific way of herding animals because you have, in a way, to adapt to them, to follow them, because they're migrating animals.
How do the reindeer herders, the Samis who herd them, how do they keep track of them? Are the reindeer marked in some way? I mean, how do they know whose reindeer is whose?
Yes, they are. They are marked in a very traditional way with special drawing made with a knife. And each person, each Sami, has its own marks. It's even registered in a book.
Hmm. You know, some of your photos of the reindeer herds are quite striking. One that caught my eye was, it's a sort of a medium shot. It's from above. And there's a bunch of reindeer close together. And when you initially look at it, the reindeer, their bodies and their antlers fill the frame. And the antlers almost look like trees, bare trees in the winter. How did you actually take that picture from above?
I took that on a boat. It was at the end of the migration. Some herds migrate in an island, so they have to cross the sea. And to avoid many losses because of drowning, some herders hire big boats to put the herd in, and then they can cross the sea, put them in the island. And so it's very spectacular because the reindeer are not used to be locked. So suddenly they are locked in a boat. They're panicking, and so they're turning all around.
Suddenly close quarters for a wild animal.
Yeah, most of the time you're not so close from the reindeer because, as we said, they are wild and most of the herders keep very far away from them.
I have to ask, I've always heard that reindeer produce a clicking sound when they walk. Did you hear that clicking?
Yes. It's actually the only sound they make because they are silent animals. And yes, it's the, I don't know in English how to say the feet of the reindeer. I don't know the word.
Hooves, the hooves.
The hooves, yes. It's the hooves that makes that sound, click, click, click.
As a photographer, you're obviously deeply concerned with light. And the quality of the light that far north is something quite spectacular. It's also incredibly different from where you grew up in southern France. How do you sort of adapt to that? How do you take that on as a photographer?
In a way, it's so easy to be a photographer up there because the quality of light is amazing. The way it's caressing the skin of the people, the landscape, it's so soft and so cold at the same time, very bluish light.
Celine Clenay is a photographer based in Paris. She's been documenting the Sami people and their reindeer herds in the Norwegian Lapland. And you can see some of her images at PRI.org. Thanks, Celine.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Tens of thousands of Chinese journalists are getting ready to be put to the test, literally. For the first time, China's government is going to make journalists take a test in order to receive their press cards. The questions are focused on Marxist ideology and Communist Party doctrine. Here in the studio with me is The World's Matthew Bell.
Hello, Comrade Hills.
Hello, Comrade Bell. You were just in China to do some reporting, and I want to put you on the spot. Here are a couple of the test questions that the New York Times has on its China blog.
Okay.
What is the essence of socialism with Chinese characteristics? A, social harmony. B, comfortable standard of living. C, comfortable standard of living for all. D, the four modernizations.
Carol, I'm going to have to go with A, social harmony, because I know that the party has mentioned that as a goal.
And you are correct. All right, another question. Comrade Xi Jinping has said that the Chinese dream is essentially the dream of blank. Is it A, the people, B, the working class, C, the Communist Party of China, or D, all Chinese people around the world?
That one I'm going to have to completely guess at because I can't claim to really understand what the Chinese dream is when the president of China talks about it. How about D?
I'm sorry, it was A, the people.
Mm-hmm.
Another question. What is the most basic principle of news ethics in our country? What is the most basic principle of Western news ethics? And you may choose more than one.
Okay.
A, the principle of social responsibility. B, the principle of serving the people. C, the principle of journalistic professionalism. Or D, the principle of freedom of the press.
So what I learned in journalism school was professionalism. I'm going to go with journalistic professionalism.
You are incorrect. It's B and C. B, the principle of serving the people, and D, the principle of freedom of the press.
Right.
So, Matthew, this was a pretty tough test for you.
It was. And to be very clear, I would not have to take the test to work as a journalist, either temporarily or on a long-term basis in China. This is really for the 250,000 or so Chinese journalists, people that are going to be applying for press credentials, press cards, and interestingly, this is the first time that the government has made Chinese journalists take a test like this.
Comes at an interesting time. As I read through these questions, I'm thinking China seems so non-ideological in terms of it being the toy shop of the world and business and cranes and buildings. So it's interesting that they're going back to a kind of an ideological model.
Yeah, and we've seen sort of in the margins a bit of freedom of speech and freedom of the press expanding in China. But the truth is that for a long time, the news media was state-run, state-owned, and very strictly controlled and censored by the government, and that is still largely the case. I think what's going on now and what the test is all about, really, is that the government is sending a message to journalists and saying, look, and it says so explicitly in the 700-page manual that journalists are supposed to study to prepare for this test, it says that the relationship between the party, the Chinese Communist Party, and the news media is one between the leaders and the led. So that's the point there, is that we're in charge, we're going to be deciding where the red lines are, where you can report and where you can't. And I think it's a pretty powerful message.
Well, to take the test yourself, find the link on our website. That's at PRI.org. Thanks, Matthew.
You're welcome.
By this point, you may have had enough of Santa and Christmas. Well, we have the antidote for you. Here's Alina Simone with this week's Sideways Glance, our regular look at those stories that make us do a double take.
Do you remember that awesome fairy tale about the little girl who cut off her finger so that her bone could open the cage where her brothers were held prisoner? No? It's called The Seven Ravens, and it's from the Brothers Grimm. In my Russian family, that's what we call the bedtime story. Growing up with these dark, unpredictable tales did something to me. After that, Disney always came off as too safe, too happy, and ditto for that most cheerful of holidays, Christmas. So when I heard about a party celebrating not Saint Nick, but Krampus, his cloven-hooved, chain-swinging Eastern European sidekick, I thought, that sounds like fun. Joanna Ebenstein is the founder of Morbid Anatomy Library, which has been hosting Krampus Fest for years now. She discovered the anti-Santa in 1994 at a Burger King in Hungary.
standing next to St. Nicholas was this demonic figure. He had hooves and he had horns and he was carrying chains. And I'd never seen anything like this before. This was at the Burger King. This is just like your standard go shake Santa's hand. And I had some friends in Hungary and I was like, what is that? And they explained, oh, that's Krampus. You guys don't have Krampus? Well, I just became really curious about the roots of Christmas and how surprised I was that there ever was a dark part of Christmas. You just don't think of it that way. You know, Santa, they say he knows if you're going to be naughty or nice, but really nothing happens to you if you're naughty. If you're naughty in Hungary, you could get hauled away by this demon and beaten with chains. Like, it's a very different situation. I just thought it was kind of fascinating.
Joanna finds a lot of strange things kind of fascinating. A lot of things she's fascinated by are also kind of dead. As I chat with her here at Morbid Anatomy in Brooklyn, I'm facing a real human skeleton and a two-headed taxidermied duck.
You know, my whole life I've been called morbid for being interested in these things. I don't find it dark. I find it that any curious human being wants to know about this stuff. That's how I feel about it. It's just my own curiosity unfettered by conventions, I guess.
I meet one of Joanna's merrily morbid comrades the next night at Krampusfest. Laetitia Berbier came here from Paris 2 years ago to work on her art history dissertation. She's wearing a necklace made from coyote bones and what looks like the exact opposite of a Christmas sweater.
It's a Krampus sweater. I bought it on the internet. In France, we don't have a tradition of Christmas jumpers or sweaters. So when I came here and I discovered this, like, you know, bizarre, negative, tacky version of like a Christmas sweater, I totally, you know, fell in love with it.
Laetitia never finished the dissertation. Now she's head librarian at Morbid Anatomy. And she met her husband here too, at a taxidermy competition. I see him wandering around, dressed, of course, as Krampus. This party is definitely more Halloween, less Christmas, but it's anything but morbid. Next year, Morbid Anatomy will take over a three-story former nightclub and transform into a museum. Joanna says their first exhibit will feature the whimsical taxidermy of British artist Walter Potter.
So really, the Morbid Anatomy Museum will celebrate things that fall between the cracks, let's say that. So it's a bit larger than death. I'm interested in death because nobody looks at it. I'm interested in Krampus because nobody looks at it. I'm interested in Walter Potter because very few people look at it.
I ask Joanna just what it is about obscure and morbid subject matter that appeals to her so much. And I tell her I'm not immune, perhaps given my own childhood diet of dark fairy tales.
When I was a kid, I really responded to things that didn't have happy endings. And you might call that dark, but for some, it made me feel. And I liked feeling. And maybe, I don't know, maybe that's something that Americans don't like to do. I'm not sure.
Maybe. But Joanna will have a chance to change that. After 7 years of running Morbid Anatomy as a labor of love, she has a new salaried position as creative director of the Morbid Anatomy Museum. But I don't want to call that a happy ending. So, happy beginning, Joanna. For the World, this is Alina Simone in New York.
You'll definitely want to check out Alina's photos from Krampusfest. We have them at PRI.org. This is PRI. I'm Carol Hills, ahead on the world, wondering how NSA leaker Edward Snowden is spending Christmas in Russia? Reporter Barton Gelman recently went to Moscow for 14 hours of interviews with Snowden.
He's a guy who spends a lot of time in front of the screen and always has. He lives on ramen noodles and chips, and he's pretty happy with that.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Edward Snowden's decision to leak a huge cache of top-secret documents ranks among the most talked-about stories of 2013. And while the former NSA contractor seems to be living a quiet life in Moscow these days, he's slated to release a Christmas video tomorrow. The holiday message reportedly warns of the dangers of mass surveillance. It's not the only talking Snowden's been doing.
doing, he recently gave a lengthy interview to Washington Post contributor Barton Gellman. Gellman was one of the three journalists who received Snowden's trove of secret documents last spring. Gellman says for the most part, Snowden is holed up in his Moscow residence, and he didn't part the curtains or step outside once during their 14 hours of interviews.
He's one of those people who doesn't see any big reason to go outside very often. He's interested in the world of ideas and in communication with reporters, with friends, with lawyers on the keyboard. And he's not telling me at all who he's communicating with, but he's a guy who spends a lot of time in front of the screen and always has. He lives on ramen noodles and chips, and he's pretty happy with that.
Does he worry at all that Russia is using him as a pawn?
Look, he's not in Russia by choice. He was literally just changing planes there when the United States revoked his passport. And so he's been obliged to stay. He says he has no contact with the Russian government, no relationship, takes no money, offers them no information. So what he's doing is he is accepting asylum there as any other asylee would. And he is participating to the extent he wants to in this sort of global debate about surveillance that he galvanized.
Now, one thing we found interesting was that Edward Snowden told you that many of his colleagues were sort of troubled to learn, his colleagues at the NSA, where they were troubled to learn that the U.S. intelligence agencies are, quote, collecting more in the United States on Americans than we are on Russians in Russia. Did he give you the sense at all that there are other like-minded souls in the NSA, that he's not the lone wolf that he's being portrayed as?
Oh, I think that is exactly the sense he was giving. He can't claim to speak for a majority. No one polls inside a secret organization of 30,000 people to see who is supporting the program and who is not. Clearly, he believes that the great majority there believe in what they're doing, believe that they have an important mission. But he said that quite a few other people who he talked to shared his qualms about how far they go.
Snowden, in his interview with you, mentioned about giving his colleagues the front page test. What is that?
It's actually quite a startling thing for someone to do who is beginning to lay plans to make this spectacular leak to reporters. But he went around to coworkers and he showed them a particular program. Actually, it's a front end onto NSA systems called Boundless Informant, a name which says quite a lot by itself. And he showed them the system. He showed them the volume of data that's being collected just en masse about the American population, especially about its phone records and also internet records. And he said, what do you think people would say if this showed up on the front page of the newspaper? And he said that quite a few people recognized that this would be a problem, that it would surprise most Americans and it would distress quite a few.
He took a ton of documents. Is there sort of a mechanism in place for what happens to the rest of them? I mean, is there sort of a dribble, dribble, drip, drip method? Is there sort of a trigger ready if he's arrested? Did he say how that would play out at all?
He says absolutely nothing about how much he took or where it is or whether it's in more than one cache. I can tell you that there's not one single set of documents and that he has tried to play no role whatsoever in what the reporters he gave them to do with those documents. So he gave me and two other journalists substantial archives of material. He has not tried even once since, and I would not allow him to tell me what to publish or when or what to hold back. He asked us explicitly to use our own judgment about what was news and what would be harmful to security.
So now that you have a lot of that stuff, are you going to be releasing more and more stuff yourself?
I found it wise not to talk a lot about future reporting plans, but I'm not done with the story.
Barton, your clandestine contact with Snowden, you have this relationship with him. He selected you as one of the journalists to pass on his document cache to. Do you ever think that the line between journalist and player gets kind of blurred?
Certainly not in this case. Edward Snowden is a source. He is someone who was inside an organization, who was not authorized to speak to me, who thought he had important news, and I thought so too. He took precautions to avoid being prevented from talking to me and to avoid being preempted. This is all fairly normal functionally. It was just at a fairly extreme degree in the sense that the material he had to give was much more sensitive than anything I, and frankly, I think just about anyone has received before. And the precautions he took to do so confidentially had to be greater because he was trying to, in effect, blow the whistle on the world's most powerful surveillance agency without being surveilled.
But do you worry at all that there'll be some sort of retaliation toward you?
I'm not going to make any predictions about repercussions on me, but I will say that I was doing my job as it's supposed to be done.
Reporter Barton Gellman, he's a contributor to The Washington Post and a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. Thank you so much, Barton.
Thank you.
Alan Turing operated in secrecy. The British mathematician was pivotal in helping the Allies win World War II, but his role was kept classified for many years. Turing suffered greatly after the war. He was convicted of homosexual activity at a time when Britain made being gay a crime. But finally, after more than 50 years, Alan Turing has received a posthumous pardon. The World's Bradley Campbell has the story.
Without Alan Turing, World War II may have gone a different way.
Until Turing came along with his wonderful work, our ships were being sunk by the German submarines, I hate to say.
Jean Barker is a conservative member of the House of Lords. She worked with Turing at Britain's Code and Cipher School at Bletchley Park. It was there that Turing was tasked with the impossible, crack the Enigma code. Nazi Germany used the secret messaging system to position submarines with lethal results. The thought at the time was that if you could crack the code, you could win the war. And Turing cracked the code.
And it was only when we, thanks to Turing, could read the German U-boat code, that was when the war really turned, because, quite frankly, we could have lost the war through starvation.
Barker, like many, believes that Turing's work helped shorten the war, saving thousands of lives. She thinks he's very much a hero of World War II, but his work at the time was classified, so he didn't receive a hero's bounty. He was also gay, and in 1950s England, that could get you into trouble. A British court convicted him of homosexual activity in 1952. His punishment? Chemical castration. It's a process that pumped female hormones into his body. 2 years later, he died of cyanide poisoning. A coroner ruled it a suicide. Mathematician Barry Cooper of Leeds University likes to remind people that Turing was only 41 at the time.
He was a tremendously inventive scientist. And of course, in science, it's very difficult to predict what somebody would have done, but it was a huge talent that was lost.
Cooper says in that short life, Turing helped develop theoretical computer science.
He saw the possibilities of the computer before the computers even existed.
He even created a test to judge artificial intelligence.
The kind of developments that have completely changed the world we live in.
In the decades following his death, stories of his accomplishments didn't stay secret. They hit a fever pitch in 2009, when tens of thousands of people signed a petition for his official pardon. In a move that maybe only Turing could have foreseen, those signatures were collected online. The effort prompted an official apology from then-Prime Minister Gordon Brown. He said Turing's treatment was unfair. Quote, "So on behalf of the British government and all those who live freely thanks to Alan's work, I'm very proud to say we're sorry. You deserved so much better." For many, though, this apology wasn't enough. The lobbying for a pardon continued. It culminated with the Justice Minister making a formal request to the Queen for a posthumous royal pardon. That's what the Queen just granted. For John Sharkey, the news was a long time coming. Sharkey is a Liberal Democratic Member of Parliament. He's been a prominent voice lobbying for a pardon.
It recognizes a great injustice to Alan Turing. And it recognizes, I think, in part, that he was a very great man and a great British hero.
But British human rights campaigner Peter Tatchell won't be toasting the Queen just yet.
It's wrong to give someone a pardon just because they're famous.
In other words, we need to remember that Turing was just one of many people punished for being gay.
50,000 plus men who, likewise, with Alan Turing, suffered this fate, but they are not being offered an apology or a pardon.
Tatchell hopes the government will open up the pardon process to more victims. He argues that everyone should be equal under the law. But at the very least, the long-awaited pardon of Alan Turing is a start. For The World, I'm Bradley Campbell.
He was called Montreal's Teflon Don. Vito Rizzuto was at one time Canada's most powerful crime boss. As head of the Rizzuto family, his criminal activities stretched across the border into the U.S. and as far away as Italy. Rizzuto died yesterday of natural causes in a hospital in Montreal. He was 67. Journalist Adrian Humphreys has written extensively about the Rizzutos. Adrian Humphreys, I have to admit, I didn't know who Vito Rizzuto was.
I would say that's the way he would like it. The only people he wanted to know who he was were the people he was doing business with. They're the ones that mattered, and they certainly knew him. Vito Rizzuto was born in Sicily into a Sicilian gangster clan. He emigrated to Canada at the age of 8, and together with his father, he built an awesome criminal empire. Montreal used to be like a branch plant of the New York Mafia, the Bonanno family, one of the five families.
Yes, absolutely.
But his family managed to eclipse all of the New York mobsters in terms of its geographic stretch, in terms of its dollar value, in terms of its manpower. He became a global super boss, the biggest name in Canadian crime, but one of the biggest mafia bosses on the world stage.
What were his illegal businesses of choice?
The bones of the family was built on heroin. They were one of the early mafia families, to really have a foray into South America. There was a mob war that they fled, and they settled in Venezuela to hide out. And while they were there, they realized that there was $1 billion to be made there. So they went from heroin, cocaine, drug trafficking was certainly their bread and butter. But once they became the geographic bosses of Montreal, which is a huge city, they took a percentage of like every significant crime that took place in the city.
It sounds like he's one of the rare members of his family to die of natural causes.
I mean, the mafia is a dangerous game. People know that. But for so long, the family was untouchable. They were always at the right end of a gun barrel throughout all their time. His family had absolute control and power, final say in the underworld across Canada and into, you know, large parts of the globe. But Vito Rizzuto's inner circle were arrested in Canada in a police operation. Vito himself was arrested and charged in New York City for a famous gangland murder in 1981. It was a murder of the three captains that was colorfully remade in the Donnie Brasco movie. That put him in prison in the United States in recent years. It took 20 years to solve that shooting. And while he was off the streets, he couldn't control it. He built up so many enemies and created such resentment, and people saw so much of an opportunity with him off the street that he was under attack. His eldest son was shot dead on the street. Then his father was shot by a sniper while he was sitting down to dinner in his home. His brother-in-law snatched off the street, believed to have been tortured, and then he's never been seen since and assumed to be dead. Many of his closest colleagues were also attacked. People were writing him off. They assumed when he was released from prison just a year ago in October that he was a dead man walking, that there's no way he could survive. But survive he did, and he thrived. And against all odds, he actually regained his throne just by the sheer force of his personality and his strategic decisions he made.
I'm surprised he was even let out of prison, given his record. How did that happen?
It was a large indictment against New York mafioso for those three murders. It was a racketeering indictment, not a murder indictment, because it had happened more than 20 years before. And he fought extradition from Canada for like 3 years. By the time he finally got to New York to face trial, every single other member of the Bonanno crime family had faced trial for it and be given 20 years or more. He was the last. By this time, prosecutors were a little weary. They knew that when he was finally released, because he's a foreign national, he's Canadian, of Italian birth, he would be deported. It just seemed the easiest to accept a plea deal for 10 years.
Now, Vito Rizzuto has passed away. Is there an obvious successor?
No, and this is at least not that we know of. This is going to be the tricky part. His organization was so large, and it takes a tremendous skill set to hold the reins of that. And we saw that just you know, a few years in prison, and it all started to fall apart. So I don't think any one man can fill his shoes. His ability to sort of choose his heir and install him as the boss while he's still alive to make sure that people actually follow the new boss's orders, that opportunity's gone now. So someone's going to have to come in cold, and there's going to be a lot of competition for that spot.
Adrian Humphreys is a journalist with the National Post. He's the author of The Sixth Family, The Collapse of the New York Mafia and the Rise of Vito Rizzuto. Thanks, Adrian.
Thank you, Carol.
This is PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Our world quiz today takes us somewhere. I'm not sure where, so let's hear the clues.
I'm standing atop one of the world's greatest structures. It's made from 52,800 tons of high tensile silicon steel, held together by more than 6 million rivets. I'm looking out across a beautiful harbor. There's a gentle northeasterly blowing in from the Pacific Ocean. There are ferries carving beautiful wake through the water. There's a flock of geese flying overhead, and it's a beautiful morning.
The clues again were 6 million rivets and a busy harbor in the Pacific. So can you guess where this guy is standing? His voice is a tip-off.
G'day. My name's Phil Roach, and I'm a climb leader. I'm standing in the most unusual place, atop the Sydney Harbour Bridge. I'm looking out across our magnificent city as it wakes up and heads to work. What a beautiful morning. It's an extraordinary job. It helps you develop a really strong sense of place. I'll climb the bridge about 4 days a week, sometimes 3 times a day. I never get nervous. I suppose I'm blessed in that way. Even when I was young, I used to climb to the tops of the highest trees. I've always been very adventurous. Certainly for our climbers who come, it can be a bit of a challenge, but they're guided by a very experienced team to achieve their goal of standing atop the bridge. You are standing on an exposed steel girder suspended in space, and you're looking out across the most beautiful city vista anywhere in the world. On our climb to the summit this morning, we saw a magnificent flock of white sulfur-crested cockatoos, that very distinctive large Australian parrot. They were ducking and cartwheeling and weaving between all of the girders up here on the bridge. We also have 2 resident ravens, large blackbirds, that live on the bridge, and they're very affectionate. We know them quite well, us climb leaders, and we've nicknamed them Russell and Cheryl Crow. They have a little nest here on the bridge. People, when they reach the summit, well, you get all kinds of reactions. Climbing up's a bit of a thigh buster. So generally everybody wants to cheer and throw their arms up in the air, and there's a lot of cheering, a few high fives. Some people, though, have very emotional reactions to the view. We've had people break down in tears, reflecting on their own personal achievements. It really is a heroic feeling standing up here to see the sun rise out of the Pacific Ocean, to see all of that light spilling across the harbour and lighting up the sails of the Opera House is just magnificent. You feel like you're the king of the world. This is climb leader Phil Roach standing atop the Sydney Harbour Bridge. G'day.
That's Phil Roach of Bridge Climb Sydney. And watch your step getting down off the Sydney Harbour Bridge. There are lots of ways to celebrate Christmas. In Mexico, many people host reenactments of Mary and Joseph seeking shelter on the eve of the birth of Jesus. The tradition dates back 500 years. Spanish missionaries created the ritual to tell the story of Jesus to the indigenous people. It's called Las Posadas. Here's reporter Beto Arcos with his own story of a posada in Los Angeles.
For the past 10 years, my family and I have organized Las Posadas at our home in L.A. We invite close friends and neighbors to join us. At about 7 p.m., we walk in our neighborhood toward the first place we're going to ask for posada, or shelter. Tonight, there are more than 30 adults and about 10 kids. We arrive at our first stop. About 5 of us go inside a neighbor's house. The rest stay outside, each holding a songbook in one hand and a candle in the other. The group begins the posada song, singing in call and response. The lyrics say, "In heaven's name, I ask for shelter, since my beloved wife cannot go walking in the night." Then, inside, the smaller group responds, "This is not a hostel. Go on ahead. I will not open the door. I'm afraid it might be a thief." At our second stop, the lyrics continue the story. "We're so tired of walking all the way from Nazareth. I'm a carpenter. My name is Joseph." Inside the house, the owners respond, "I don't care about the name. Let me sleep. I insist on telling you, I will not open the door." Finally, at our last stop, the response is different. "Are you Joseph? Is your wife Mary? Please come in, pilgrims. I did not recognize you." As we walk in, everyone sings the welcoming verses. "Come in, holy pilgrims. Though our home is poor, we offer it to you from the heart." This last place is our home, and we have a party for everyone. In Mexico, the family hosting the posada is responsible for feeding everyone. But we're in the U.S., so guests bring tamales or a bottle of wine. As the hosts of the posada, we have to make an essential element in this Mexican celebration: ponche. This hot punch is made with apples, guavas, and sugarcane, as well as raisins, prunes, hibiscus, cinnamon, and brown sugar. Oh, and there's a special seasonal Mexican fruit called tejocote. That's very important. You can't make ponche without it. Finally, we get to the exciting part. It's time to break piñatas. You see, the piñata breaking tradition actually goes back to the earliest posadas in Mexico. Piñatas were made with 7 points to represent the 7 cardinal sins: wrath, greed, sloth, pride, lust, envy, and gluttony. The idea is to hit each one of the points blindfolded, get rid of the bad stuff in your life, and usher in a new life and a new year. That's the tradition of Las Posadas. Here's wishing you and your family Feliz Navidad. For the world, I'm Beto Arcos, Los Angeles. La Virgen se está peinando entre cortina y cortina. Los cabellos son de oro y el peine de plata fina.
That's it for us on this Christmas Eve. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Have a happy holiday.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. The Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. And by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.